Welcome to the podcast, Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. And I'm your host, Mike Allen. Last week, we kicked off this two-part series entitled 20,000 Leagues Under Long Island Sound. If you're back, you're like me. You simply had to hear the rest of the story from our guest about how this disaster, the sinking of the S-48 Navy sub off the coast of Fairfield with 41 men aboard, ended, including who survived it and how they managed to do it. Well, back to finish telling us one of the greatest seafaring tales in Connecticut history is Mike Bilava. He's a Connecticut-based historian, author of Wicked Bridgeport and Wicked New Haven, and just a great storyteller. He'll be along in just a moment to help us put the finishing touches on this captivating saga. This week's trivia question: what was the first town settled in Connecticut? Was it Hartford, Wethersfield, or Windsor? Stick around after the main program for the answer, because then you'll know the topic for next week's show. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is brought to you by our sponsor, Yale New Haven Health. When people need the best quality health care, there's a reason they turn to Yale New Haven Health. In 1826, Yale New Haven Hospital became Connecticut's very first hospital. They were the first hospital in the U.S. to use chemotherapy. Yale New Haven was the first to introduce insulin pumps for diabetic patients. And they introduced the world's first intensive care unit for newborns. For more information about Yale New Haven Health, visit YNHHS.org. That's YNHHS.org. Last week, in part one of this spellbinding tale, we kicked off our two-part series about the sinking of the S-48. It was a new submarine built by Simon Lake's company, the Lake Torpedo Boat Company of Bridgeport. Lake was born in New Jersey in the 1800s, but had moved to Connecticut and proceeded to build the world's first seaworthy submarine. Well, along the way, Lake developed the S-class of submarines for the military, and the new S-48 was on a routine sea trial in December of 1921, a little more than 100 years ago. The 41-man crew took off from Bridgeport on its way to the U.S. Navy base in New London. There, they planned to pick up a few more crew and then head out to the waters near Block Island in Long Island Sound for dives in 200 feet of water to get their certification for the sub. Now, as we recounted in part one, it was shortly after they left Bridgeport, about 4 miles east of the Penfield Reef Lighthouse off the coast of Fairfield, when the sub started taking on huge amounts of water from the sound and promptly sank. Now, if you envision a pencil, the back of the sub or the eraser was dragging along the bottom of the sound until it fell into a divot-shaped hole and came to rest. The front of the sub, the Flint, was pointing just slightly upwards, but was still 60 to 70 feet below the surface. Now, not only was the sub hopelessly waterlogged, but the seawater started to fill up the compartment where the onboard batteries for the electrical system were housed. Now, the combination of that salt water and battery acid produced poisonous chlorine gas, the same type used in World War I. It filled the vessel with a greenish poisonous gas that could not be expelled. Several brave men used tin coffee cups and rubber tubing to siphon the water away from the batteries into an area where the only two still functioning pumps on board the sub were able to discharge the water back out into the sound. Now, these men burned their hands, their lips, and their mouths on the acid throughout the 12-hour ordeal. The communication system that would have let them issue an SOS distress call had, for some still unknown reason, not yet been installed. The crew decided that their only hope was to reduce the weight in the front of the sub as much as possible in the hope that the tip would rise upwards above the surface of the water of the sound. They shot off the dummy missiles that they had on board. Those weighed 2 tons, and they even wrote messages on the side of the missiles in the hope that somebody would see them. They ended up then removing 5 tons of iron bars called pig iron that had been on board to replicate the human weight that a fully staffed submarine would have been carrying. Well, this laborious process consisted of each of the 200 bars being ejected from a special compartment on the sub into the icy waters, one by one, with a human chain moving those bars throughout the vessel. Well, we've got you back to the point where we'll now bring in our first-class storyteller, Connecticut-based author and historian Michael Bilava, to pick up the story, which frankly only gets more amazing from here. I would say now it was about 4 hours after the sinking when the folks in New London realized that, well, the sub is not here. What did they do?
When the S-48 didn't arrive in New London on schedule, they became concerned, and they contacted the Lake Boat Company in Bridgeport to find out, you know, what's the story? Did the boat leave? Did the S-48 leave on time? Yes, the boat did leave, immediately realized it had never arrived in New London. They themselves started a search, the Navy, to scour Long Island Sound, but not knowing where the boat had submerged at any point between Bridgeport and New London, literally a needle in the haystack. They did go out to search. The public was never informed, which seems incredible nowadays, but the families were never informed that the boat was lost. They didn't know where it was. The company and the Navy Department said that they didn't want to create a panic across the Connecticut coast. They were trying to come to grips with what they were going to do and hope that things would work out for the best while they were doing a surface search. But what could they do? It was already late in the day. It was the beginning of December, winter. Between the time of the test dive off of Penfield Reef Light and the time that they realized the S-48 was not in New London, a half gale just crashed across Long Island Sound. So it was stormy. The wind was blowing. There were snow squalls. There was little that could be accomplished, you know, with a surface search at night in a storm.
Now back to the crew, the 41 folks on this submerged sub. They're racking their brains. They've tried everything. They've gotten rid of pig iron. They've cut the anchors. They've shot out the dummy torpedoes. Everything they can try to do to limit the weight or reduce the weight in the front end of the pencil, the flint end, so it would sort of rise up and go above the surface so they could get out of the boat. They're trying everything. And finally, 6 hours after they have sunk, and by the way, I'm just going to say right here, it's amazing that panic didn't ensue inside the sub, much less the public along the coast. The commander, Austin, does a big gamble because he doesn't have a lot of air left. Everybody's trying to conserve their breathing, to conserve what oxygen is left. And he decides, let me blast the water that's in the ballast tanks out of there with what I've got left. And that was pretty gutsy.
Yeah, it was very gutsy. Captain Austin took a huge gamble. What else could one do? The boat hasn't moved enough to surface, and they're stuck in a craft with water that's nonstop coming in, and the chlorine gas cannot be filtered out of the boat. They're in complete dire situation. He blasts, you know, what air remains, you know, through the main ballast tanks. That is enough of a weight differential that the boat does rise up, actually at a really sharp angle now. Quite suddenly, the boat rises, and people who aren't holding on to anything start to roll back down through the compartments. So they're holding on. The boat is rising. They're probably clunking their heads and they're hitting their body parts, getting bruised, but they don't care because they know the boat is now pointing skyward towards the surface of Long Island Sound. Does it break the water? They don't know yet. They're not sure.
And now we come back to Pete Dunne, the boxer. And this is, you know, not that it hasn't been harrowing already, this story, but this is where it really gets incredible. He goes forward, gets permission to go forward to the torpedo room. And what does he do in this 21-inch wide torpedo shaft?
Pete Dunne was a boxer, so he's in really good shape. He's 5'10", and he weighs 160 pounds. He's a slender guy, so he's able to squeeze his way into the torpedo tube that's now facing upward at a sharp angle. They opened the exterior, the exit hatch for the torpedo tube slightly just to see if any seawater would come crashing down the tube, which would tell them that the bow of the boat hadn't broken the surface of the sound. When no water crashed down, they put Pete into the tube, shut the torpedo entrance, and they opened the exterior. He shimmied his way up with a rope tied around his waist, a big length of rope, and a hammer. The hammer he was holding was, once he got further into the tube, if water actually did start crashing in, he could bang on the side of the metal tube and inform people, I got to get out of here, the tube is filling with salt water. Well, it was above the sound. It was above the water line, actually much higher than they had anticipated. It was 15 feet, maybe more. Now, Pete Dunne shimmied out of that hole, and when his head and shoulders popped out into the night air, immediately he's freezing. The huge storm. There's waves crashing over the bow of the submarine, and he could see through the storm, through the snow squalls, the lights of Bridgeport. And he'd never seen a more beautiful sight than that, is what how he would explain it later. And he got out of the tube, holding onto the rope, and he couldn't find anything, any surface to obtain a grip by hand or foot on the straight hull of the submarine. And so he figured, he knows that there's a cleat on the other side of the boat. Attempts to get to the other side. Waves are knocking him into the water. He does get the rope around the cleat, and inside the submarine, the men are waiting. Well, it's been kind of a long time. You know, what's going on outside? In the meantime, he had secured the rope around the cleat, but a huge wave had smashed him off of the boat and into the sound. So the second man up and out of the tube was able to rescue Pete Dunne, and actually took a third crew member to rescue those two who were just being battered by the waves against the side of the submarine. Pete Dunne's major fear, he had explained later, was that once he was outside of the torpedo tube and exposed to the winter air, and now seeing that there was a half gale blowing, that he would become frozen, stuck to the side of the sub, unable to move. Well, once he was taken out of the water and rescued from drowning, he fumbled, you know, unwillingly his way down through the torpedo tube, and he hit the inclined deck of the boat inside, passed out. He went out with just his woolen undergarments, and those clothes were just frozen fast to his body. They weren't even sure if Pete Dunne was dead or alive.
Unbelievable. What did they do?
The story was far from over, because even though they could now get some fresh air into the boat, they were still stuck on the bottom. They were concerned that the boat could slip under the waves again. Remember, the huge storm. It could sink suddenly. Chlorine gas was still in the boat. Yes, some of it, of course, was exiting through the open torpedo tubes now, but not at a rate that could be healthy. The whole thing was they had to communicate their distress. How can they tell anybody that they were stuck here in the middle of the sound in a storm in peril? So they tried flashlights, SOS, flashlight beams. I mean, they just weren't cutting through the squall. So they started taking up their clothing and dunking it in oil or diesel, and they were setting their clothing on fire. It finally came down to the fact that the last mattress on board, they set a fire as they were clinging to the bow that was projecting above the water. They set that mattress on fire, and there was a tugboat for the Standard Oil Company, and they were pulling a metal barge from New Haven to Brooklyn. The captain on board that tug thought he saw a flashing light, and then he thought he saw something red flickering. So he figured it was a private vessel that was on fire. There was a problem. So he ordered the crew to take the tugboat and the barge toward that light that now had vanished. But he was sure he saw something. Went towards the light, and they could see, the captain and the first mate could see the silhouette. They weren't quite sure what it was through the storm, through the blowing snow, the wind. The first mate thought it was a downed airplane that was just propped up out of the water. They couldn't tell what this dark, shadowy shape was looming before them. So the captain, Captain Olson, ordered his tug to go around, you know, circumnavigate this strange apparatus to find out what it was. The men on board the bow that were just clinging still on to the submarine were screaming, both overjoyed that the rescue was possible, but also as a warning, back off, back off. They couldn't be heard in the storm. So Captain Olson unknowingly dragged the barge over the submerged part of the submarine and crashed into the conning tower. The boat started to really rock and jar. The men on board were shocked at what's happening now, because this grinding metal sound has just, ensconced the entire hull of the submarine, and it just goes on seemingly forever. The barge is so long. They were totally afraid that the boat would be pushed back to the bottom. And once the barge did pass over, one of the tow lines got ensnared across the hull of the submarine and was pushing the sub down. So men scrambled up that line under the barge, took the line off of the barge, and removed that tension that was pushing the submarine back under the water. So some of the crewmen were already now on the barge, rescued. It was all coming together in Captain Olson's mind that this was some kind of submerged vessel, submarine, boat, whatever. And then he backed off immediately, and that's when they decided we're going to use our emergency rowboat to go back and forth and ferry the crew. Everybody on board that Standard Oil tug volunteered, I mean down to the cook, to volunteer to go into that rowboat and do whatever was needed to be done to rescue whoever was on board that sunken submarine. After four trips back and forth, they got the 41 men off of the sunken S-48. And remember, the storm kept pushing the rowboat here and there. The tugboat was being pushed by the waves and the storm further away from the sunken sub. The operation was by no means even straightforward and easy then. It was a miracle that nobody perished. The emergency rowboat didn't capsize. On and on and on. It was a moment-by-moment miracle that day.
41 members of that crew all came up through that torpedo shaft?
Yes. They all were able to fit their way through the torpedo shaft and then shimmy down a line into the rowboat and then to be ferried back.
Needless to say, some of the crew members had to be hospitalized for some time to get over the exposure and chlorine gas incidents and whatnot, but many of them just went right back, didn't they?
Once all the men were rescued from the sunken sub, they were brought to Brooklyn Naval Yard, and within the day, they were discharged medically. There were a handful of individuals who had to stay at the hospital, and you are right, Mike. Exposure to the cold and the seawater in the sunken boat, one thing, but also respiratory ailments. The chlorine gas had seared individuals' lungs, and they had to stay in the hospital.
Simon Lake, whose company made this submarine, wrote in his autobiography later that there was a worker who was working in the area, and what did he leave undone that caused this whole thing to happen?
Yeah, in Simon Lake's autobiography, he surmised that the S-48 was sunk by a worker. At the time, he'd been putting back a cover over the hull, and that got called away on lunch. Of course, this is all his assumption. Called away from lunch, did not put the remaining bolts in the cover, left it undone. And after his lunch break, he didn't return to complete that same job. He'd been called away to a different task. It slipped his mind incredibly, as he would seem something as impossible as that, but he didn't complete the task. So when the boat went out into the sound, everything looks secure, the size of a manhole cover. There's that plate. It's in place, but not properly attached. And that's what caused the submarine to sink. Water flooding in through that hole. Once they submerged, the water burst that cover off.
Something I have trouble personally understanding, just to draw an analogy here, after John F. Kennedy was assassinated, they cleaned up that limousine and put it back into service. Similarly, the S-48, after this incredible incident, it went back to work, didn't it?
The S-48 was resurrected. They had taken two massive barges with lines between them. It was about a two to three week job. They raised that boat, brought it back to Bridgeport. The boat was repaired. And before it was commissioned, they had to still achieve, the tests and about diving and everything else that was associated with confirming that the boat was safe. So some of the same crew were on board the S-48 when it went back out just a few months later and did successfully achieve those 200-foot test dives off of Block Island. Now, the folks that were on board said every man that had been on the original sinking of that boat, that they just took it as another day on the job. I'm sure that the hairs in the back of their necks went up and that a cold sweat crossed their brow, you know, when they heard that dive alarm sound and that they started to submerge. I'm sure that there had to have been some tension. And, of course, an exhale, a sigh of great relief, of course, when the boat was rising and then did break the surface of the sound during those subsequent test dives.
Yet another reason why we should honor the men on Veterans Day.
Oh, of course. All the gentlemen, the crew on board the S-48 when it went down was comprised of mostly the workers from the Bridgeport area and naval personnel. Those men, they never lost their cool. They never lost their calm. They supported each other. They came together. They did what was needed. And because of that and their genius, they survived that ordeal. That's the only reason that those 41 men shimmied through that torpedo tube and were able to walk the streets of Bridgeport once again. That's the reason why.
The 200 pig iron bars that the crew offloaded to help raise the front end of the sub, well, they've never been recovered, to the best of Michael's knowledge. He wants to recover them and create a memorial from them to make sure the story of this incredible incident is never, ever forgotten. Wraps up this episode of Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. When the S-48 submarine was originally christened nearly a year before the ill-fated voyage, representatives of Connecticut's Mohegan Indian tribe took part. In fact, it was one of their members who actually broke the bottle of champagne across the hull of the sub, bestowing good fortune on the vessel. There were many who pointed to that ritual as a source of the good luck that pulled the crew members through the ordeal. I want to thank our guest for these past two programs, Michael Belava, Connecticut-based historian, author of Wicked Bridgeport and Wicked New Haven, and just a fantastic storyteller. The answer to this week's trivia question, the question was, what was the first town settled in Connecticut, Hartford, Wethersfield, or Windsor? Well, the answer is, it's a little bit of a trick question in that the answer is still disputed to this day. Next week on Amazing Tales CT, we'll recount the fact that most historians will say the answer is Windsor, although many in Wethersfield still argue that theirs was the first town to be settled. We'll bring in the Windsor Historical Society to try and sort out the matter. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is a production of True North Associates, LLC. This is Mike Allen. Be safe, and please stay healthy.